Hey everybody, welcome to FutureCast number 003. My name is Noah Kravitz, and this is FutureCast, where we talk with interesting people about interesting things. It's the official podcast of futuresmarter.com, which is my little blog where I'm doing stuff and sometimes not doing stuff. It's hard to find balance in this world. Anyway, today's episode is being recorded today, Wednesday, May 8th, 2013, and I am delighted to have as my guest none other than Damon Brown. Damon Brown is a journalist, an author whose work has appeared in Playboy. Full stop. Once upon a time, I would have literally full stopped there. But, you know, makes me realize how old I actually am. And I don't know, used to be, you know, just saying Playboy carried weight in many realms all at once. And not that it doesn't these days, but I don't know if Playboy is the same brand name for today's adolescent troublemakers.
Wow, we might need another episode for that.
It's a separate conversation.
Yeah, don't get me started.
But at any rate, Damon is an author, journalist, and entrepreneur based out here on the West Coast. And he is the author of more than a dozen books. Most recently, I'm going to get the name wrong here, Our Virtual Shadow, which was just published by TED Books, and I will let Damon talk about that himself in a second. But very exciting stuff, and congratulations to you. I know you're excited to be working with the folks at TED.
Thank you.
Also, you've got an app you've been working on, and you just came back from the American Society of Journalists and Authors Conference. You sit on the board there, and I saw you tweet about VentureBeat the other day. You're a man who wears... Well, I think it's all under one hat, but lots of different things going on. So, Damon, thanks for taking the time to
thank you so much
to have a chat. Why don't you? I don't know. Why don't we get started? Why don't you tell us about Our Virtual Shadow?
Sure. Yeah, thank you for the humbling intro.
Hang on. Sorry, I have a tradition of saying go ahead and talk and then interrupting people. Before we get going, you can find Damon online. This is important. You can find Damon online at damonbrown.net, damonbrown.net. You can follow him on Twitter at Brown Damon. And if folks go to damonbrown.net, they can link from there to buy as much of your work as they want to. Is that correct? Or are there other places they should look?
There's limitations as far as the amount of merchandise they can buy.
Okay.
I think
if this podcast keeps going for any length of time, I think my trademark is going to be making my guests feel uncomfortable by trying to hawk your wares for you. But you know, it's important. You gotta put food on the table.
Briefly. You know, that's one of the things that I'm on the right. That's funny in itself. Briefly, you know, that's one of the things I've been on the board of the American Society of Journalists and Authors for 3 years. I just got reelected, which is exciting. So I'll be on there for another 3 years. And it's one of the things that I always tell authors is that we're artists, but we're also business people, you know. And so, you know, I'm making jokes with you, Noah, but, you know, I really do believe that we should be compensated for our work.
Absolutely.
You know, and we put some serious effort into a lot of passion, and just like musicians, just like anyone else who's putting work out there, you have to take not only the craft seriously, but the business side seriously too.
Absolutely.
You know, so just a little sidebar for that. Let me get off my board soapbox.
No. It's my soapbox, and you're allowed to come up and speak your piece and get off of it without your reputation being tarnished. So it's all good.
Well,
I'll take the hints.
I don't know about the rap part, but.
So Our Virtual Shadow, what's that all about?
Sure. So it's called Our Virtual Shadow, Why We Are Obsessed with Documenting Our Lives Online. And the brief synopsis is that in the past two and a half years that I've been researching the topic, I've realized that there's a conflict between us living our lives and us wanting to, as the title says, document it. So for instance, you know, you and I have hung out before since we've been in the same circles for a few years. And let's say that you and I end up going to a U2 concert. So I can go ahead and tweet and say, hey, you know, Noah Kravitz and I are going to a U2 concert. I can't wait. And then, you know, we make it to the Staples Center or wherever it's going to be, which is a place down here in the LA area. So we go to the Staples Center and I go and check in on Foursquare and say, hey, we made it to Staples Center. Can't wait to see Bono and The Edge, et cetera. And then I go ahead and the show starts and I take an Instagram photo, you know? And so you're thinking about all the, it sounds extreme when I'm talking about it, but you know, many of us do that every single time we, you know, we do something,
yeah,
you know, cause we want to document this event. And as the social networks kind of multiply, then for us to have an impact and actually share these events with other people, not to mention to document it for ourselves, then we're spending even more time because it's not a matter of just being on Twitter, but it's Twitter, Google Plus, Branch, it's Facebook, it's Pinterest. I could probably go on for the rest of the show, yeah, talk about all the different networks that are out. You know, I just went to Hawaii a few weeks ago and I was vining a couple times. You know, it was crazy. Like, it's, I'm supposed to be relaxing in Hawaii.
Is Vining, you know, Vining's legal in Hawaii? They passed that?
They did. They did. Yeah, I think Delaware was yesterday.
Okay, good.
And so,
it's, and you so, know, for the uninitiated, who knows, right, what Vining could mean. But yeah, so 6-second video clips.
Exactly, 6-second video clips. And so my whole point is that, you know, it's really easy for us to get caught up in that. And my whole argument with the book is, at what point do we stop living our lives?
Yeah.
Start living our lives essentially through these filter processes.
Yep.
And I can kind of go a little bit further into that, but that's basically the bottom line with the book. And I had actually connected with Ted, you know, the conference people about a year and a half ago. They invited me to come through because they liked the stuff that myself and some of my other colleagues were doing as far as in the social media and the discussion space. The conference, like, even before, you know, I got the book deal with them, the conference just blew my mind, like, doing some amazing stuff. There's people are pretty extreme about it, where either hate Ted or love Ted. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely in the Ted lovers position, where it's like, it's just an amazing, interesting conference. At the very least, it stimulates a lot of thought for the remaining 12 months in between the conference. I know coming back this past year in February, and we end up coming up with a book deal because they have this whole thing called TED Books.
Right.
And that's another thing I can discuss with you guys. But everything about it's lovely. It just came out on Thursday, and it's been a really exciting process.
Awesome. If people – I checked myself because I heard you saying briefly. But if people want to find out more about the book, and I'm not done talking about it, but if they want to find out more about it, they can just do that through your website.
Definitely, definitely.
Okay.
So they can go to browndamon.net, and my website's formatted so that it looks fine on traditional browsers. But I would recommend if you have a tablet, like an iPad or what have you, or even an iPhone, check it out on there. I use a platform called Jux, J-U-X.
Yep.
And I think you and I have talked about it in other occasions, and absolutely love it. It looks really good. So if you look at my most recent Jux posts, you'll see an interview, Q&A, exclusive one that I did with TED itself, which was an honor. Then Computer World actually had a really good conversation with me. It was about a week ago when the book came out. We also have an excerpt of the book online. And it's important to note that the book is available on all the major ebook platforms. So it's available on the iBookstore. It's available on Kindle. It's available on the Nook. So those flat formats are great. You'll get all the content, but TED actually has an exclusive app that's available only on iOS platforms right now. So for the iPhone, iPod, and iPad, and you can actually go ahead and subscribe to all the books that are available on the TED line. I believe my book is the 31st book on there, so I'm still part of that freshman class. And so each of the books is $1.99, and that's across all the platforms. So for $2, you can buy the book. Or you can go and get a subscription, and I believe it's $15 a year as we speak. And for that $15 a year, you get a buffet of all the books.
Okay.
So you're essentially getting 31 books right now for $15.
But you can only read those – if you do the subscription, you can only read them in the TED app, and the TED app is currently only available on iOS.
You got it. Exactly.
Okay, got it.
It's a big limitation.
Yeah.
One really good motivation too, hopefully my book is part of it, but another motivation to get involved with it is that they just dropped the price. So
right.
When my book launched, right when my book was about to launch, it was $2.99. And that's been the staple for the past year that the app's been out. They just dropped the price across the board to $1.99.
Right.
And now they have the year-long subscription for $15. So it's a great bargain. You know, it's a good thing. And, you know, the other books that are with me, I couldn't be prouder. Amazing stuff.
So a million directions I want to go with this. But to go back to your book, and not to give away any spoilers, but are we spending too much time documenting our lives instead of living them? Or is it a good thing? Is it rewiring our brains? Is it, you know, what's the, I don't want to say what's the bottom line, because I know better to think there's one bottom line. But, you know, what's your take on this?
Totally. Well, there's a few different angles there, hence the book. One of the things that I found is that after you spend, you know, a period of time of your life writing a book, kind of summarizing it, even in a long program, it's always difficult. So forgive me if I'm not brief.
No.
To take one little snippet of what you were saying, kind of run with it, our brains actually aren't really changing. And that's really a misnomer. Based on the most recent scientific research, coming from different universities all around the world, which I quote and I also give direct links to in the book. The latest research, anecdotally and also with this the peer-reviewed stuff, is saying that we're not good at multitasking. Right. And one of the rubs with all the current social media we have is that it requires us to multitask. So again, if we were at the proverbial U2 concert and I'm trying to take a picture on Instagram while they're, you know, playing with or without you, you know, then I'm not going to be able to go ahead and have my brain be fully available to take in, you know.
Yeah, you're not going to be with Bono. You're going to be without him because you're tweeting about
him. Exactly. So the smell of patchouli from the person next to me, the flashing lights from whatever they have going on on the stage during this particular tour, the sound of Bono. I mean, all those little details, something has to give, something has to drop. And so when that's happening, we're trying to do the Instagram photo. And then that leads to the second point, is that when we're using something like Instagram, we're using something like Foursquare, what have you, we're taking this dynamic, multi-sensory experience, as I call it, and we're flattening it into one or two simple dimensions. And so even if we go back and say, wow, I can't remember what Bono looked like because I wasn't paying attention. Even if we went back to those social networks and said, oh, that's what Bono looked like, that's looking at Bono in a two-dimensional form within ones and zeros, not that multi-dimensional form that we'd see if we were actually paying attention during the concert.
Right. Yeah, no, it's interesting when you started talking about that and you even before you said, you know, if I'm going to a U2 concert with Noah, the example that popped in my head was actually a different old classic rock chestnut from my childhood. I went to see Springsteen for the first time, actually. But I went to see Springsteen a couple months ago. And I remember watching my friend and I, we had standing tickets on the floor. And there was this group of I'm going to call them kids. They were probably 28. But, you know, this group of youngins in front of us. And I had decided, when we got to the show, like I took a couple pictures and I tweeted something and I sent a couple texts and then I was like, I'm putting my phone away and I'm going to watch the show because, you know, I know how I get. And this group of folks in front of us, it was two couples, you know, four people. And it was interesting because I noticed, A, they were pretty drunk by the end of the show and I wasn't drinking. So just sort of, you know, more aware of that. And B, they were on their phones constantly and, you know, taking selfies. And I sort of at one point watched them like when, you know, they're pretty visibly tipsy, you know, get it together enough to like take a bunch of self photos, post them to Facebook, and then, you know, kind of get together and watch the Facebook reactions and everything. And, you know, I'm not trying to call, throw stones in a glass house because instead of watching the show, I was watching them. But you know, still, it's I mean, I do it at home all the time with watching TV, and I'll be watching TV with my phone in the hand. And I'm a big, you know this about me, I'm a big basketball fan.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm watching the NBA playoffs lately. And I've been lately not tweeting during the games very much because I start getting into that and I miss the game. And it's, you know, I don't think the research on multitasking is necessarily brand new, but it's certainly, you know, coming up in a really, really direct light these days. And it's funny that the second example I thought of, and then I'll be quiet, because I want to hear also from you about, this is kind of out of nowhere, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on PATH, actually, because PATH's been in the news lately with their
sure
privacy stuff. But the second thing that came up about shows is a year or so ago, I was actually down in Southern California for work and flying back up to Oakland. Make it sound like I'm a jet setter, and I'm not. But flying back to Oakland that night, and Prince was playing up here. And I'd seen Prince once before in New York. He's a musical hero of mine. Really wanted to see him, but, you know, he'd actually, I think, added last minute, added another show that night, and et cetera, et cetera. And I remember I got back to Oakland Airport, took the shuttle bus to the parking lot to get my car, and while I was waiting for the bus, I checked my phone, and there was a Facebook status update from a friend of mine, something about a Sheila E. drum solo. And so I texted him, and I was like, "Are you at the show?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "How far into it are they?" And he said, "Oh, you know, they've been playing for like half an hour." And I kind of did the mental arithmetic that was like, yeah, it's totally going to be worth it to get over there and, you know, catch the rest of the show. And so I did, and it was great. And, you know, I felt like a rock star flying into town and catching the second half of the Prince show. But, you know, so it's interesting because on the one hand, I don't know, there's so many dimensions to this and so many dimensions to the whole, you know, alone together kind of thing with social networking.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is to take a quick step back with the multitasking part. The multitasking evidence, you're right, it has been around for a little while, but there's also another layer to it where scientists are now realizing, at least some scientists, not all, but some scientists are now realizing and now arguing that when we're not fully present for something, then our memories aren't as strong either, and we're more likely to forget something.
Right. Right.
And so imagine like some monumental thing like I talk about the day I got married. That's kind of one of the things I discuss in our virtual shadow, and the discussion that my wife and I had about should we use social media that day or not, you know.
Right.
And you know, but imagine like forgetting that day because you're so busy on Twitter.
Right.
How sad is that?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And so now there's scientific evidence popping up, like peer-reviewed scientific evidence saying that our brain actually needs to be fully present to remember things longer.
Right.
And so that's kind of the concern where it's like we end up using these tools because we're afraid we'll forget something, but by using these very tools, we might actually forget it.
Right. No,
so
right.
It's amazing
exactly.
Irony.
Exactly.
As soon as I discovered some of this research and then I talked with Ted about it, I was like, you know what? This we need to address this.
Yeah.
We need to talk about this.
No, it's great because I think it's really it'd be really interesting to see, you know, this generation that's growing up on social media is even a step beyond, you know, my sort of personal revelation I've had over the past 5 years about this generation that's growing up with their lives being documented, even just locally, so much more than they used to be because, you know, now everybody, or almost everybody anyway, has a camera and a video recorder in their pocket all the time, you know, and so that the number of photos and videos being taken of, you know, especially, you know, you mentioned, you know, getting married or you know, I know lots of new parents with little kids who, you know, now that you've got an iPhone in your pocket or another, you know, smartphone with a decent camera on it. And it's just so much, it's so easy to do it. But then you add that dimension of once you've taken the photo or the video, you want to share it, you want to pin it somewhere, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's – I'm so glad we're having this conversation now, and I got really lucky with the timing of the book because now, of course, the big tech story probably of this year is Google Glass, right?
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting because
– Don't get me started.
I'm sure. You know I am though, right? but you know, but they came through – I'm not sure if you heard, but they came through to TED and did a presentation about Google Glass at the last minute. You know, and so I actually, you know, got a chance to see that while I was at TED a couple months ago in February. And so it was interesting where Google's basic argument was that, hey, we're going to go ahead and it's so obtrusive to take something out of your pocket, have to pull up the app, go ahead, decide what you're going to use, take a photo, and then share, put it back in your pocket. By putting this thing on your face, then it's going to go and take that intrusion away. And it's fascinating to see the feedback where, in some cases, it's the opposite, where you permanently are looking at things through this particular lens.
Right.
And so just fascinating stuff. I mean, this is such a scary and exciting and strange year for technology. So yeah. I'm just happy to be part of the discussion. This is fascinating.
I should throw in that in addition to just sort of being a junior tinfoil hat wearer these days, it's funny when we were talking about the formats your book is available in. I moved over from using an iPhone all the time to using Android devices, 9 months or so ago now. And so when you mentioned to me, if you can check it out through the TED app, and I went and couldn't find the TED app on the Android device, that was also around the same time that I was finally like, I've had this library book out now for 5 weeks. I need to start reading the thing. And it's Cory Doctorow's Little Brother, which I don't know if you have read, but a really good book. I've been a fan of his, because I like the way he writes about ideas, but this book, I've read 3 or 4 of his books, and this one to me is the best written of the books that I've written so far, just as far as storytelling goes. I also tend to like young adult fiction. And now I can hear Michael Selvidge laughing at me for making that comment, but that's a separate thing. And this is a really good book about imagining a not too distant future where there's the first like really major post 9/11 terrorist attack on U.S. soil, and this 17-year-old hacker kid gets picked up by the government as a suspect and sort of what happens. And so privacy on the brain for sure is the point. And, with Glass, it's like the first thing I read about it that made me see a positive with it was a post actually from Scoble, I think, Robert Scoble on G+, talking about what an amazing tool for photographers it is. And that what you just described, being able to take photos, it's always there. And once the subject of your photography or video, sort of gets used to it a little bit, they stop posing for the camera and it's natural and all this stuff. But my take on it so far has always been, A, just the privacy nightmare, and B, having another lens between, me
literally,
and reality.
Actually,
literally.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to say, I mean, people use that analogy for a reason. And I mean, if I could jump in, it was interesting where...
Oh, you're the guest. You should jump in.
I have a tendency to do that. Also, because I do hosting, so I it's just yeah. my
nature
we all, to say
we
that.
We all love to talk. It's,
we do, right? Hence our jobs. One of my favorite Silicon Valley journalists, Violet Blue. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're familiar with their work, but fascinating. We're actually pretty cool, so I love seeing her when I'm up in SF. And I mentioned her in the book briefly, but she's been like on the front lines as far as discussing Google Glass, and it's been interesting since I actually haven't accessed the Google Glass before. I haven't used it yet, so it's interesting to kind of have people, the 500 or so. Explorers, or it might be 5,000. I'm forgetting.
I heard 2,000 that actually have them.
Okay.
I know some folks who signed up who got theirs, and I know some folks who signed up who haven't gotten theirs yet.
Okay, so, well, maybe technically it's 5,000, but only half of them have gotten
it,
or something.
Like that. Yeah.
Something with a five. Yeah. But it's only a handful of people relative to the amount of people that are interested.
Sure.
And she's been kind of on the front lines in that, and she's talking about how the Google setup is currently like Siri, Apple's Apple's automated voice system, on the iPhone and on the iPad, in that whatever commands you put in, it goes back to Google's server.
Right.
It's not localized.
Yep.
And so there's already some talk and already some proof that there's censorship happening. And one of Violet Blue's followers had mentioned and said, Violet Blue also writes about sexuality.
Yeah.
And one of her followers was like, you know what? what if Google ends up saying, you know, you can't watch this particular type of pornography, or you can't take a picture of this right. based on some type of recognition or whatever. Yeah. So you really open up the doors. Like, it's not, this is not junior, you know, tinfoil hat talk. It's like, yeah. no, it really yeah. is a very strong issue.
Yeah. Google has, this is a rumor, but I believe they have nipple recognition technology in-house. So, you know.
You're just kidding, right? I hope I'm kidding.
I think I'm kidding.
You notice I had to pause though. I'm usually good with success, but.
I know. I was like, oh, man, that joke just fell flat, but you were taking it to the serious level. And yeah, I mean, so Google Now is one of the two big reasons that I like Android right now are Google Now and widgets. And if you put them together, you get the Google Now widget, which, you know, Google Now on iOS is not the same thing for me because I have the Google Now widget on my phone's home screen. And it's great. It's not perfect at all. It's terrible at real-time sports scores. But, you know, but it... It just, I don't know if you've used it, but it just...
No, not yet.
Yeah, so basically it's akin to what you were saying about Siri. It if you sign in, you know, it basically tracks everything you do via your Google account, web searching, email, all that stuff. And you can set preferences and you can, as you go, sort of in a Pandora-style fashion, you know, tell it more of this, less of this, that kind of thing. And it gives you automatic... updates on your either in the app or on your widget about, you know, sports scores, weathers, stock information. They've now added flight status. They've now added yesterday I bought something off of eBay, and this morning, this morning Michael Selvidge is going to be the not present cameo star of this podcast, because this morning when I turned on my phone, the Google Now had one of the updates on the widget was, it's Michael Selvidge's birthday, a little photo of him. And another one was, you know, your blah, blah, blah you bought off eBay yesterday shipped. And so, you know, it's able to now suggest things to you based on your email activity, your social networks you're logged into, or G+ anyway. And then also, if you're signed into Google Web Search, it'll look at stories you've read and suggest additional stories. It was actually funny the other day. It suggested to me a story about free places you can watch the NBA playoffs online. And I was kind of like, that's funny because TNT doesn't want me to know about that.
No, they don't.
Yeah. But anyway, to your point, you know, it's this thing happening now, and it gets back to that generational thing, I think, because I wonder how much, you know, however many years from now, how much the current generation or what they're going to view privacy as. Because there are all of these services that the more access you give the service to your personal information, the better the service becomes. Obviously,
we saw the very beginning of that. I'm a big food guy. So we saw the very beginning of that probably about 5 or 6 years ago when we started seeing the loyalty cards with the different grocery stores.
Right.
And that's a, you know, kind of an early example, but people usually forget about that. They think about like, oh, tech, they're going to talk about Google, they're going to talk about Apple, Microsoft, et cetera. It's like, no, this stuff has been happening over the past decade. We just haven't realized it.
Fast track? Do you drive? You have a...
No, but you know, I'm originally from the East Coast. I go there quite a bit. So I'm totally familiar with Fast Track and there's another version of it, I believe, up in the Bay, right?
Fast Track's in
the Bay.
Easy Pass.
Yeah, Easy Pass is West Coast or East Coast,
East
right?
Coast,
totally.
Yeah. Yep.
But yeah, they're the same thing, right?
And it's the same thing. And I believe, I may have this wrong because in my household, I don't handle most of the bill paying, because if I did, we wouldn't have heat, electricity, or a place to live anymore. But I just to be that stereotypical American white male who can't handle his business. That's me, everybody. But I believe that in the Bay Area, they made it with Fast Track that you get a financial discount if you use Fast Track as opposed to paying cash when you go, you know, over the Bay Bridge or whatever.
Yeah, I was just up in the Bay about 3 weeks ago and rented a car, and that was part of the
right,
deal.
Right. Car rental places have it now too. Last time I rented a car, they said, you know, do you want to do you want to add on the automatic payment service thing? And, you know, that data gets tracked somewhere. Does it actually get used? I don't think the state of California is using it because we don't have enough money to keep, you know, the essential government employees employed. But you know, that data gets used. And if you want to go, I mean, again, going back to the book I just read, go buy Damon's book first. And then if you have some money left over, check out Cory Doctorow.
It's $2. Just don't get coffee today. That's all there you got to do.
There you go. Or get it on your loyalty card. You already, you know. But in a dystopian nightmare future, which might not be that far off, you know, there are data mining programs that are not even looking at, you know, what did Damon Brown use his fast track for and where has he been going, but just looking for anomalies. And, you know, here's an anomaly in all of the Google Glass data that's been collected. Well, wait a second. This one user's been, you know, looking at and recording and accessing a lot of stuff that doesn't fit the pattern. We better go check, you know, check her out. Like, I don't know. That's sort of the nightmare thing. But speaking of privacy, have you used Path?
Yeah.
Okay. So I signed up for Path a while ago, spent about 5 minutes with it, and was like, this isn't really for me. I haven't used it since, so I can't really comment other than that. A very smart, trusted person who's very tech savvy recommended Path to me a few months ago as a, you know, sort of private social networking kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, for the second time in recent memory, Path's in the news for alleged privacy violations.
Right. I think, yeah, and I would even be as bold to say that it's past the alleged part.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I know you're trying to be PC about it.
For once, yeah. No, right. It's,
right. I'm a little bit shocked. I'm like, I'm the one that's to get rid of the alleged.
Well, they settled, or they paid an $800,000 fine a few months back. And
something
then
like that.
Something
yeah.
like that for some sort of privacy user privacy violations. And then this time around, there's a blog post that got a lot of traction from a digital marketer claiming that when he signed up, Path basically spammed all of his contacts. And because of the way that some of the local phone services work, those SMS-based messages got turned into robocalls. So he had people in his phone book literally getting called in the wee hours of the morning saying, you know, your friend blah 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 just signed up for Path. Would you like to access his photos or something like that? What's right. going on with that?
I think you hit the nail on the head. So the basic idea is that you have to, I think it started with when Path really started to take off about, I would say about a year ago, maybe a little bit further back. And Apple basically has this policy, or changed their policy, I believe. Either Apple changed their policy, or they started enforcing their already set policy that you had to get permission to access people's contact info. And I mean the contact info as far as everyone in your address book and all their details.
Right.
And so I know Path was doing that, as well as some other social network type of things. I think Instagram might have been doing that too. So all of a sudden, everyone had to go and update their apps, including Path, and say, hey, can we get permission to go ahead and check out your contact book? I actually joined Path just over a year ago, I believe. And the story struck me as odd because I didn't have that happen to me at all.
Right.
I have a handful of friends that are on Path, and I have quite a few colleagues that are on Path. And they haven't had that issue either. So for me, I was trying to parser, you know, trying to separate the this is a bug in the system to this being a privacy issue. I don't think it's blown out of proportion. I think it is a genuine concern. But I think it's really important to realize that it might have been just some poor programming or a bug on Pat's part, and not something where they consciously said, hey, let's go ahead and spam everyone, just like we saw with the early Facebook app developers, you know, 5-6 years ago. I think a lot of people have learned that lesson now.
Right.
They're not going to automatically. I mean, how much money is invested in Path right now?
Yeah.
How many big wigs are connected to it? I mean, they're not going to make a move like that on purpose. I would almost guarantee that. So I think it's really important to separate that part from the hype. you know.
But isn't it? And I'm looking. I'm trying to type silently in the background so you don't hear a lot of these noises on the podcast. All right. I guess if I'm going to actually just call it out there, then I can do it.
I think you can do it. Right.
But. And I also, this is in my head today because I read earlier this morning that Path is going to be preloaded now on some Sprint phones.
I didn't know that. Is that breaking news?
Yeah. Breaking news, like earlier this morning, or I don't know when you're listening to this, people of the citizens of the universe, but Wednesday morning, it was announced it's going to be on the Galaxy GS4, or the Galaxy S4, the HTC One, and one of the other devices.
Nice. That's a pretty big coup.
It is. It's on Sprint, so not as big of a coup as, you know, AT&T or whoever, but yeah. I believe what happened is that Path made a conscious move, I believe, to defaulting when you sign up. Everything gets like automatically invite all my contacts to Path or something like that.
Wow. I've been on there or involved with it for about just over a year now. So that wasn't an issue when I joined. If that was a conscious decision on their part, then they should probably change their mind back. I mean, I know for myself, I mean, just like yourself, I'm, you know, my background is journalism. So, you know, I have a pretty darn good Rolodex.
Right.
And I would be embarrassed, if not angry, if I am spamming all the people that I know. Like, it would be a deal breaker. I'd have to leave the social network.
So in case anybody is listening to this, and because you just said the J word, I want to make sure we get this right. I'm reading this off of the unauthorized Apple weblog. Digital marketer Stephen Kenwright downloaded the app to his phone, tried it, then removed it. The next morning, he discovered that despite the app being removed, a good many of his contacts had gotten robocalls and texts saying that Kenwright wanted to share items with them through Path. As The Verge explains, the robocalls were an unintended side effect of the way some phone companies handle texts. Turn them into voice calls. And then he wasn't alone, and there were a bunch of more cases that said it. Path acknowledged that... here it is. Okay. Like every time you play a Zynga game, Path will try to make sure you draw in as many of your Facebook contacts as possible. However, the default in this feature is turned on, not off. So that was the thing.
Wow.
When you sign up, it's defaulted to on. And then since then, Facebook... Facebook denied Path API access for a little while. Mm-hmm. And then the first report was May 1st. Now it's May 6th. I'm reading also from TUAW.com. The reason behind the application's ostensibly strange behavior is that the default setting is such that the app reaches out to a user's Facebook friends and asks them to try out Path. Consequently, if users want to avoid spamming their friends, they have to proactively toggle the option off. As one might expect, Path wasn't entirely apologetic, noting that the process is meant to simplify the friend-finding process, adding that the app is really best with friends, and that the company wants to help users invite the people, blah, 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 blah. All that said, Path updated their app. It doesn't address the aforementioned default setting. It does include... an enhanced privacy setting, and the Find My Facebook Friends functionality in Path has now been removed.
Now, what's beautiful about this, and that now I'm realizing why this doesn't make sense, and I think they're really trying to, if I can use, I hate this word, but I think you can really tell that they're trying to pivot.
Right.
Right. Let's say, I know you're sick of this word.
No, it's fine. I was sick of it, and then I went into hiding for 6 months.
So I wouldn't say right, yet. Totally. And I left. I'm in Southern California now, so I could say it without irony or cringing. But you can tell they're trying to pivot because if you know anything about the history of Path, when it first started getting serious and started getting a lot of press about a year and a half ago, I want to say in late 2011, mm-hmm. their main thing was that they put a limitation on the amount of people that you can connect with.
Right.
I want to say 50 was the max at the time.
It's 150 as of now or as of very recently.
But it used to be, it used to be 50.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to say 50. It might have been 100, but I'm almost positive it was 50 when I first got involved with it. And so that's one of the things that's cool with Path. Just to give some personal things for me, I have 8 friends on Path, and that's it.
Right.
I mean, that's it. Like,
right.
You know, that's it. I've gotten some requests, obviously, and all that stuff, but that's it. That's all I got.
Yeah.
You know, and so it ends up being a different type of use case,
I'd say,
than Facebook or Twitter or whatever. But that's what's so funny is that, you know, going and spamming, you know, my thousands of contacts would be the antithesis of what they originally said Path was going to be.
Right. But as you mentioned, you know, how much money is invested in them? The CEO got written up in Vanity Fair, which infamously led John Gruber to call the guy a douchebag. I don't know if you read that.
I heard about the Vanity Fair thing. I did not know about the fireball stuff.
Dave Morin, I don't know any of these people. I'm just, you know, re-reporting.
Actually, I met him at TED a couple of years ago. Not to be a star guy about it, but
no,
I met him.
Yeah, do it.
He seemed like all right guy, all right. But, you know.
There was a quote in there about, you know, it was this little article about, you know, like, what phone, it's about your phone, what phone do you use, what's on your phone, what apps, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, I read that. Never mind.
Yeah, and he said something about how he's got, like a bespoke app to help him, communicate with his personal assistant or something like that. And then he said, I don't use a ringtone because I always want to be on the offensive, not the defensive.
Right.
And as he's want to do and frankly quite good at doing, John Gruber on during Fireball, you know, pull quoted a little bit of that and said, Path CEO Dave Morin, total douchebag, or something like that, which, you know, whether or not he is, it was a pretty pithy burn to the whole thing of, you know, not having a ringtone.
That might be the phrase of this talk is right. A pithy burn. I love that.
A pithy burn. Maybe that's going to be the title of this episode. Futurecast 003, a pithy burn with Brown
pithy
Damon.
Burn.
Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, tangent aside, name dropping aside, you know, all the money, the Vanity Fair thing, the recent cover, the FTC or whatever it was, the $800,000 fine originally, the coverage now, including this recent pretty breakneck pace growth to 10 million users. And there's something that happens, and it's happened to me on a very, very small scale, even with this little, you know, I decided to get back into producing content of some sort. And promised myself I wasn't going to look at website analytics. That lasted about 6 hours. And the next thing I knew, I was just obsessed with page views. And we're talking about very, very small page views. And so I'm sure when you've got tens of million dollars, you know, from big name, high stress VCs behind you, and, you know, you're being called a D-bag on one of the most widely read tech blogs in the world, and you just cross the, how many figures is 10 million? The 8-figure mark of users. It might just get easy to lose sight of, you know, your original reason for being, and instead look at, you know, growth over user concerns, perhaps. I don't know.
Totally. And I mean, that's actually a really good segue with, the reason why the TED book came out was because myself and my co-founder, Kurt Collins, who you know, and he and I go back a little while. He's at this point,
he's a good guy.
Thank you. But he's a startup veteran, at least compared to me. So he's been involved with a lot of projects. And the book actually, TED book actually came out because we were working on our own app for the past 2.5 years called a quote unquote. And that was one of the things with the process that I learned, actually two things. The first thing was that there are certain limitations to social media. And that, of course, is how the book originated, because I was like, wait, we're relying on social media to we're essentially outsourcing our memories to social media, but social media can't capture all the things that our brain can. What's up with that? So that's so simple as that. That's why I can describe the last, I don't know.
Have you seen the new Galaxy S4 ad at the graduation pool party where the dad looks at the phone and smells a picture of food on the grill? And he's like, oh, I think I can smell it.
Wow,
So we're getting there. We're getting closer. Multi-dimensional memories.
We're getting closer. And actually, Parag Khanna, who's actually a TED speaker and author of his own TED book called Hybrid Reality. We had a really good conversation earlier this year when I was working on our virtual shadow. And that's what he was saying to me, where he was like, listen, you know, that hybrid reality between technology and so-called RL or real life, like that's getting blurrier and blurrier. So there will be a period of time where, you know, your mother will be able to hug you from, you know, 1,000 miles away, or you'll be able to go ahead and smell stuff from the bakery that, you know, that you grew up by in Jersey or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? I believe him, but that stuff is far away. I'm not sure if I can curse in this podcast, but but that stuff is far away. Now, I'm not talking like, you know, 3D gun far away, but I'm talking like...
Right. Oh, God, don't say that.
Right, let's not go on a tangent.
So, I'm sorry, no, finish your thought.
No, I was just going to say, you know, that is, it's not right here, and it's not even like... It's not even a few years away. It's a little ways away.
Yeah.
And even when we have those, then they still, I believe, won't be able to capture the same thing, the multi-layered experience of actually being present for something. So that's how the book came about. It was through this quote-unquote app.
Right.
And the second thing, which is kind of what made me start thinking about it, is that one of the reasons why Kurt and I have spent 2.5 years on it, just bootstrapping and kind of being in the basement until recently, was that we wanted to be really clear about our mission and what our goal was. And our goal was to go ahead and help you capture little snippets, little moments of interesting parts of conversations, point blank, end of story. You know, and wherever it goes from there, it goes from there. But we have a mission statement. We have all these different details that are already in place. So, you know, knock on wood, when the app launches later on this spring, then, you know, we'll be prepared for even catering to a very small audience.
That's a nice mysterious teaser, and I'm going to go ahead and say you did that on purpose, and don't contradict me, for teasing the imminent launch or semi imminent of quote unquote this app you built with Kurt Collins and input from others, coming to the iOS platform, I assume.
It is. We're going to start with the iOS platform. To be frank, from a developer standpoint, it's obviously the largest platform. And then it's also, it's the easiest. And, you know, as far as the tools right now are really catering. And I feel like that whole nother soapbox, but I feel like that Google and some of the other platforms are kind of focused on all these other aspects of development, which is cool. I feel like that with iOS, we have enough tools to please consider this to be the launch platform, and so it'll be launching on the iPhone.
Yeah, and I said easiest. I didn't mean easiest. I think I meant best.
Wow.
You mentioned. Well, I mean, best for development. And I say that like not even second hand, but like ninth hand, because I'm really good at breaking WordPress code, but that's about it. But you mentioned Jux earlier, and I have a good friend, or kind of a mutual friend, because you've chatted with him at least, who he's actually not with Jux anymore. He's working with I don't know if they're stealth, so I shouldn't say, but
okay.
He's doing iOS development with another company.
Please do an introduction, if I can say that on the air. I'd love to talk with him more.
Absolutely, yes. You know, this guy we're talking about is an iOS dev, and a long time ago, a year or so ago, when I thought I was going to be building, or at least, you know, managing the building of some iPad software for school use, he was going to do the initial development of it, and we got to talking about other platforms, and he was like, you know, I'm not even interested. Like the iOS dev tools, you know, it's just that's what I want to do. because their focus and everything's focused on, you know, design of good apps, and design meaning, you know, internal, external functionality, you know, the way it looks visually, all that stuff. I don't want to say he's a fanboy who drinks Kool-Aid, but he is an iOS fan. But even still, I've heard that echoed a lot, that, you know, what I took from what you just said about developing on that platform.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, is that, you know, I won't claim the best. And I know that my partner Kurt's tech background and programming background, you know, we both have a programming background. And I did a lot of programming in a past life. But his is much stronger. And like I said, he's worked with different startups and helped a couple of those go public. So right. So for him, he understands technology better than I do. And with the extensive conversations we've had over the past, you know, like I said, almost 3 years now, and, you know, I can tell that that's, you know, that there's, it's just a stronger platform right now. And right now we want to just go ahead and get that universality, for lack of a better term.
Right.
So that's a whole other soapbox as far as with the amount of platforms that Android currently has. And we just like the stability right now, be able to say, hey, we're going to release this app and it's going to be compatible with all these all the different iOS platforms.
Right.
And so I realized I want to apologize to the listeners because I didn't actually describe what the app does. So I should probably do
So I was going to interrupt you and someone like me to interrupt a guest and just talk for 20 minutes, but I was going to do it anyway and ask you to describe the app. But then I thought you were doing the whole mysterious tease angle to, you know, capturing snippets and social media and something, but it'll be out later this spring, so stay tuned. But if you want to describe it, please.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, it really is a simple app. And I think that's something that both Kurt and I are very proud of. It's, you know, it might change your life, but that's, you know, if it changes your life, then that's a beautiful thing. And so the basic app is this. Let's say that me, you, and Kurt are having a conversation over some coffee. And Kurt, as he's wont to do, says something ridiculous.
We're just throwing people under the bus left and right. This CEO, I don't know. I heard he's a
douchebag.
Kurt,
you know, my partner in crime with this app.
Best friend forever. He's ridiculous.
Yeah, he's crazy.
Okay, so you Kurt know. Says something crazy.
Kurt says something crazy, or more importantly, let's say Selvage says something crazy.
There you go.
So let's say
it's his birthday today as we're recording this.
Okay,
his actual birthday, as Google Now told me this morning.
All right. Well, we both know Selvage pretty well, so this will be his birthday present.
Excellent.
So me, you, and Selvage are having a birthday drink tonight.
All right.
And Selvage says something in his infinite younger than both of us wisdom, and so he says something. It's not available on the Android, so you wouldn't pull your phone out.
Right.
But let's say I pull my phone out, right? And I go ahead and we've been beta testing, so I actually have it on my phone. So I go and pull it out. I tap the quote unquote app, and I go and let's say Selvage says, you know, I am.
This whole time, Selvage is making fun of me for not having an iPhone. Is also what's happening. He's just brutally and he is, and I don't say this about many people, whether it's true or not. But he is far more clever and wittier in a real-time way than I am. So he's just destroying my sense of self while you're, you know, tapping your little app. So thanks for that, Damon.
I'm really glad that you're in the East Bay and not near him right now.
Yeah.
And so Selvage goes and says, you know, wow, you're rocking an Android, right? So that's his quote.
Yeah.
Quote, you're rocking an Android, unquote. So what I do is I pull out my iPhone, I pull up the quote unquote app, and I go ahead and type in, wow, you're rocking an Android. And then I can go ahead and say, this is the quote, this is who said it. So I'm gonna go ahead and add in his Twitter handle, which is what we're using right now since Twitter is the most popular medium for these types of things. So put in his Twitter handle, which is Selviano, right? So we go ahead and put in his Twitter handle, and I'll say, we're at this location. So let's say we're at one of your favorite neighborhood pubs in the East Bay. So I put in the location using Foursquare. And then I go ahead and say, I typed it in, obviously, but also that Noah was present. And then I can make it Are you typing?
I am, because this is going to be good. Trust me. It's working.
Oh, okay. And then, I'm sorry. I totally got distracted by...
I know.
It sounded like it was a cat on your keyboard.
Yeah, no.
And so you go...
It's my ADD, but it'll be worth it.
All right, awesome. And so you go ahead and put in the quote, you know, wow, you're rocking an Android. And then it was Salviano that said it, so Michael Salvage. And then I was present, as well as Noah Kravitz, and putting his handle in there as well. It was at this location, so Foursquare is built in there. You don't have to be a Foursquare member,
okay,
but Foursquare is automatically built in there using what we call an API, right? Use the Foursquare API, and it says, oh, okay, we're at Joe's Pub in Oakland. Cool. And then it'll go ahead and say, do you want to make this public? Which means it'll be in the quote-unquote news feed, and other people can share it or whatever. Do you want to make it anonymous? So if he said something ridiculous.
This is what he said. So I was typing. I was IMing him. And I said, if you, me, and Damon were hanging out and I used my Android phone, what would you say to make fun of me? And he said, I'd probably make a comment about your operating system like, ooh, is that 1.6?
Right. Yeah. So that's the quote. There you go.
That's the quote. Yeah.
Right? And so you can go ahead and make it public. That means all the details are available. You can make it anonymous, and that means that if it was something that was particularly embarrassing or something that you didn't want to attribute to anyone, the quote will just be floating in the ether. There won't be any details to it.
Okay.
And finally, it'll be private, which is my favorite setting, because that means that no one else would know it exists except for the people who were there. So that means that only me, you, and Salvage would actually know that the quote existed at all.
Right.
And so that's the whole app, and that's it. And, of course, if it's a public or even anonymous thing, you can share that onto your favorite social network. And we're starting with Twitter when we do launch. And so that's the whole app, really simple. And my thing is that Kurt loves the idea of connecting with people,
yeah,
and communicating with people. I love the idea of storytelling. Obviously, with my background as a journalist,
mm-hmm,
you know, I love the idea of storytelling and essentially enabling people to tell their own stories. So I don't know, you know, I have a couple favorite bars in San Francisco, and I don't know how many nights that I've been there with my friends and they've said something amazing, or we've overheard someone say something amazing.
Right.
And it's one of those things where it's like, wow, remember who said that 4 years ago when we were hanging out at that one bar in Soma?
Right.
What did they say? What was the context of that?
So essentially, you guys made a bespoke app to encourage your eavesdropping on innocent bystanders' habits. That's really nice, Damon. Terrific. Way to go. That's great.
Well, yeah. You know, well, what's beautiful about it is that it's almost like a Rorschach test. So it ought to... Sorry, I'm channeling Salvage here. I'm teasing you, but I'm also being very sincere.
Yeah.
Where it's almost like a Rorschach test, though. One of the best experiences that Kurt and I had, we were at the TED conference for the first time. It was almost a year and a half ago now. And we were just starting to talk to people about the app, because we were starting to feel secure about it. We had the alpha up and going. We kind of knew that we wanted to go forward with it. We worked out a lot of the kinks, more from the philosophy aspect as opposed to the technical aspect, which I think is a very important thing.
Mm-hmm.
It took us a year to figure out the philosophy of the app. Like, that was really, really important to both of us. So we finally had that down. We shared it with someone at the TED conference, and someone that, you know, we probably would never see again for the rest of our lives. And this guy had a background in architecture. And so we're sitting there chatting, and he said, you know what you guys did? You guys are actually creating the history of objects. And we're like, what are you talking about? You know, Kurt's talking about, you know, the communicating and connecting with people. I'm talking about, you know, turning people into narrators. This guy's talking about buildings. And it's like, what are you talking about? And so he was like, you know, imagine being able to go to the Eiffel Tower and go ahead and say what stuff was said here over the last 10 years. Marriage proposals. It could be people breaking up.
Right.
It could be people, even though it's all gated, but it could be people threatening to jump. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff.
Right.
I'm sure that Paris had an anniversary over the last couple of decades, some anniversary. So it could have been a celebration going on there. So to be able to do that
French don't celebrate things, from what I hear on TV. I don't know. I only have basic cable, so I don't know.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. You need to have the special channels right. like Cinemax to understand.
Yeah, exactly. But that, no, that's really interesting though. Like adding in that physical world element of tying it down to the geolocation, you know?
And, yeah. So it's simple stuff like that. And that's one of the things that I discuss a lot in the book. And I promise the book isn't just about quote unquote, I only mention it a few times, but it's more about the actual research that I did and the learning that I went through where I thought I understood social media. You know, I've been a full-time journalist and other things for about a decade and a half now. So, you know, I thought I knew what I was doing, but there were all these aspects where I'm like, wow, there's a chunk of life that we're not able to translate to social media, but we're depending on social media right. to tell us what our life's about. There's some type of disconnect here. And now with me creating quote unquote, you know, especially when it comes out, I'm going to be part of the problem and I'm going to be part of the solution too.
So this is something that I've been thinking a lot about lately. I'll use a real world example to kind of leap into it. I was yesterday on site for a meeting for a consulting job that I'm doing, and it was educational technology stuff. So it was like tech project and, you know, looking at computers and talking about where the pixels should go and all that stuff, and very tech savvy people, but not, not the online journalist, consumer tech centric crowd that, you know, I usually run with or where you're in my circles kind of overlap. Sure. And so, I'm using the HTC One phone right now, which is a brand new top-of-the-line Android phone with a 4.7-inch screen on it. And one of the people who I was talking to had an iPhone. It was either a 4 or a 4S, I believe, but it was an iPhone with a 3.5-inch screen on it, you know. So he was asking me about my phone, and, you know, we were sort of looking at it, and he said, yeah, you know, my wife just got the one. I said to him, one of the things I don't like about, I love this phone, but it's too big for me. And he said, yeah, you know, one of the things about my wife just got an iPhone 5, and I think even that with the longer screen is kind of too big. And so it's kind of, you know, stepping out of my usual circles and remembering, right, for all of the debate in my little corner of the internet about, you know, Android is this and iPhone is that and all the good new phones are, you know, 5 inches is the new normal size and blah, blah, blah. There's right. still like millions and millions of people who, you know, have an iPhone or are totally happy with it, let alone tens of millions of people who, you know, don't have a smartphone or don't have a cell phone at all, blah, blah, blah. So point being, my question to you, what chunk of, let's say even say the world, let's say America, you know, do you think really uses social media or really, you know, sort of relies on social media to create, you know, to document their lives and create these memories and all of the phenomena that we're talking about and that you, you know, I'm sure have described in your book and your other work, you know, what percentage of folks do you think it really applies to? And I'm not suggesting that it doesn't. I'm just curious, you know, from your more informed standpoint.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I'd say 85%.
That high. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's that high. I think it's similar to, again, I'll try to be very brief with that, but my previous book, as you know, is book called...
We've been brief this whole chat. Why stop now? So
my previous book was called Porn and Pong, How Grand Theft Auto, Tomb Raider, and Other Sexy Games Changed Our Culture. And so I ended up spending about 5 years getting into video games, which was really hard work, believe it or not, but getting to the history of video games, understanding pornography and other things, and looking at how technology has changed intimacy as well as how we view video games and other entertainment. And so it was a really fun ride, and that was probably the last really big book that I did back in 2008. And one of the things that I found when I was researching the book from 2003 to 2008 is that it was amazing how many people I talked to who said they didn't play video games. Mm. And then I continued the conversation, and they'd be like, oh, well, I play solitaire on my computer sometimes.
Right.
Or,
right.
Oh, yeah, when I'm bored, I'll go and play Tetris. Right. And so there's a certain disassociation that happens between, you know, now I'm really showing my age, but from the people that play like Halo, like you know what I mean, like the first one.
Yeah.
From the people that play Halo or whatever, Call of Duty now Part 10 or whatever they're on that mm-hmm. just came out this week, you know. But Call of Duty and Halo and all that, and the people who play Spider Solitaire and Uno, and you know, particularly over the past 5 years, all the games on Facebook.
Right.
You know, there's a certain separation with that. That's starting to get thinner and thinner now. But when the book came out 5 years ago with Porn and Pong, people did not believe they were video gamers, but they'd be spending more time playing video games than I do. You know, and I think it's the same exact thing that's happening with social yeah. media. If you ask, like, you know, somebody's grandmother or somebody's uncle or, you know, even a kid or whoever, and they'll be like, oh, I'm not really on social media. And the first thing they'll say is that I'm not on Facebook. I don't get Twitter. And people right. will say that a lot, but then right. it's like, all right, cool. So you guys are hanging out and you see that they're pinning stuff on Pinterest,
right.
you know, or right. they're going and using something on Google Plus because it's enabled on their phone. And they don't consider that a social network. It just seems like something where you can share stuff on your phone. So it really has to do with a perception thing. So that's why I really do think it's probably a little bit over 4 out of 5 Americans right now are involved with a social network and are using it to document their lives. It's just probably only about half of us actually realize we're doing it. I think that's right. one of the reasons why the book really had to come out now, where I'm like, you know, similar to Porn and Pong 5 years ago. You know, I was saying all these people are video gamers and they don't even realize it. Let me go and take a step back, give some history, you know, and show the broader audience that we're all involved in this discussion, not just people who are so-called hardcore video gamers. Right. I think the same thing with this, where it's just like, you know, we can say, oh, well, I don't document my life on social media, but then it's like people are sharing stuff on Instagram. A lot of people don't consider Instagram a social network.
Right.
I've talked to a lot of people. They don't consider it a social network, even though it has virtually the same amount of options as Facebook, literally now that Facebook acquired them. But I mean, it's just so amazing kind of see that
caffeine
difference
is not a drug, man. It's not a drug.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. It's,
you know, and so it's amazing to kind of see that transition. So I think it's quite a high kind of number of people that use social media for documentation, but they just don't realize that they do. And I think that's a misnomer that's going to change over the next few years. Hopefully this book will be part of that discussion.
Well, you know what, Damon, for as much as I'm tempted to not say anything and wind up with enough material for 5 years worth of podcasts, I think that's as good a place as any to thank you for your time and let you go. Because we literally could. We didn't even touch on the journalism conference. And I was all, when we talked before you went to the conference about getting you on here for a chat, at that time, I was all about, like, let's talk about journalism and the state of journalism and the whole Boston Marathon thing and, you know, everybody from Reddit to the New York Daily News, New York Post Whew. To, you know, CNN, yeah. like, you know.
Oh, brother.
Being so involved in all that stuff. Yeah. And
being so involved.
Yeah.
That's a really nice way to put it. Sure.
Well, right. I mean, you know, I being so involved. Hey, Redditors, you were really involved. It's a conversation I would love to have, and I would love to get somebody to sponsor us to just sit around and talk about it all day long, actually, at least for a few days. But maybe we can have that conversation another time. But for now, Damon Brown, your new book, Our Virtual Shadow, is available via TED Books on a variety of platforms, but you're recommending, if people have access to it, they go via the TED Books app on iOS. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Just real quickly, you can go to my website at damonbrown.net, and you'll see a bunch of links to the book, as well as an exclusive excerpt with TED, as well as an interview that I did with TED itself, as well as with Computer World magazine. We actually have some other stuff coming around the bend, so there'll be some other coverage going on.
Cool.
You can get all that at damonbrown.net. If you want to go directly to TED, you can go to TED, just like the person's name, mm-hmm. TED.com/TED books. And my book is the top one on there, so you can learn about the other books as well. And then if you're curious about what I'm up to, you can follow me at on Twitter at Brown Damon. That's BROWNDAMON. If you're curious about quote unquote and you want to be up to date on it, we're on Facebook and a couple other platforms. Or you go and just check out our main website at www.quq.me and see what's going on and see a couple of our favorite quotes over the past year of being in beta.
And you're are you writing for VentureBeat, or was that a one-off?
No, I'm actually doing some running for VentureBeat. Okay. Knock on wood. And then also have some other stuff that's coming around the bend. So it'll be an exciting spring.
Great.
And I really want to go ahead and I always say this with my books, but with this one, this is truly happening, is that I want to look at our virtual shadow as a launching pad to a discussion,
right?
Because it is about social media. So it's only right that we discuss it on social media. If you wanted to go ahead and you'll realize this when you get the book and you'll see it in the back. But if you want to go ahead and just join the conversation on Twitter, the hashtag is virtual shadow, all one word. And if you do a search on virtual shadow on Twitter, you'll see all the conversations that are already happening from the book coming out a few days ago.
Well, since it's no secret that I'm an entirely amateur podcast host, I have no reason not to just go ahead and admit that if the damn TED app was on Android, I would have read your book already. But instead, since it wasn't... And I was too lazy to go find my iPad. I was like, well, you know what? I can't read this, so I'm going to see if I can get that Cory Doctorow book onto the thing. And that being said, I finished it. It's actually the first book-length text I've finished in quite some time, which is a launching pad to another conversation about... I read a ton, but it's all online, and it's all articles, and it all is so conducive to going down the rabbit hole. Really nice. Very similar to the whole phenomena of documenting your life instead of living it in a way that would take explaining. But anyway.
Oh, and really quickly, to jump in, that's actually the slight spoiler. That's actually the fifth chapter out of the six chapters in the book is me talking about journalism in modern media. And so... You know, I would implore you to go ahead and check out the book. And if any of you guys are interested in that too, you know, that will probably, I think, you know, Noah, once you get a chance to read the book, then we're going to have a good discussion down the line.
Because
my opinion's all in there. So you'll know exactly where I'm coming from.
Perfect. All right. Well, Damon, a true pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk with you, but a true pleasure to do it in this context. And nothing but success for you with all of your many, many ventures. And once you guys, if you haven't done it already, once you go over and check out DamonBrown.net, you will see just how many pots Damon's got his hands in and how many texts of his are out there in the world for you to read in many, many formats. So well worth your time. Damon, thanks. Good luck with everything. And we will talk really, really soon.
Yeah, thanks, Noah. Thanks so much for having me. It was a good conversation.
You bet. I certainly enjoyed it, and sounds like you did. Hopefully somebody else out there did too, but nah, whatever. If you didn't, you're lost.
You know.
Yes. All right, that will do it for FutureCast, the official podcast of futuresmarter.com. This has been episode 003, recorded on Wednesday, May 8th, 2013, with our very special guest, Damon Brown, author, journalist, entrepreneur, app maker, all around, really, really interesting, good guy. You can follow him on the Twitter at Brown Damon. My name is Noah Kravitz. You can follow me at Noah Kravitz. And the website is futuresmarter.com. The podcast now available. There's an RSS link. You can listen to it on the site. You can listen to it over on Podomatic, where it's currently hosted. You can grab the RSS link and put it into your favorite podcatcher of choice, or of course you can do the iTunes thing. The podcast is available on iTunes as well. We will be back next time with another interesting conversation with another interesting person who I might even let get a word in edgewise. Until then, thanks for listening. Go read some stuff and talk about it. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.